French cooking has always had a certain mystique. And even though favorite chefs like Julia Child and Jacques Pépin have done their best to make it accessible, it can still feel a little out of reach. But looking past the elegant preparations, I think what's most wonderful about French cuisine is the attention to detail, to what's in season, and to how flavors really complement each other, and how wonderful a sensory experience a meal can be. Béatrice Pelt is a food writer and photographer. Not only is her new book La Tartine Gourmande, Recipes for an Inspired Life, full of delightful recipes and gorgeous photos, but she also shares where her love of food has come from, and I'd say where it's going. Bea joins us from the studios of WBGH in Boston. Bea, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you know, it's I think French cuisine has this image of being very high class, elegant, and not easy to figure out or certainly to do yourself, but you really do a great job of demystifying a lot of it and really talking about those basic, wonderful flavors that that the French and many of us enjoy so much. Why is your book, first of all, called La Tartine Gourmande?
Well, it's actually taking the same name of my food blog, which I started in November 2005, which was basically just a way for me to speak about my obsession for food. And the food blog is really La Tartine Gourmande. It is about recipes, but like you mentioned, stories that go with it and why food is at the center of those stories, because it's basically my life. So a tartine in French means an open-faced sandwich, and it's something that I think represents some, in some extent, the kinds of food that French people on a daily basis likes to eat for breakfast, but even if you think about what to accompany a soup. And gourmand is someone who really not necessarily is specific about high-end foods, but really enjoys food. And I think with my cookbook, I really wanted just to bring a sense of enjoyment, celebration of food every day. And like you said, I think a lot of people think about French food as very difficult or time-consuming. But that's not the way the French eat every day. And I wanted my book to be reflecting the foods that I was brought up eating, but with my own touches from living overseas, having traveled, and the modern age, so to speak.
I put up some photos on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R, of some tartine, because I'm a big fan, too. There's a lovely little French cafe here in Madison called La Baguette, and they have several tartine. And so I put up a photo of a plate. One is a tartine usually on toasted bread. One is with tomatoes and fresh buffalo mozzarella with a drizzle of olive oil and some oregano. Mm-hmm. Another, which I have to say is my favorite, blue cheese with prosciutto, walnuts, and sliced pears. And they're lovely, like you said, open-faced sandwiches. And then I also put a couple pictures up from a recent trip to France. One tartine that I find myself daydreaming about is about as simple as you can get: bread with toasted goat cheese on top with a drizzle of honey on it.
Yes.
So it's very simple, like you said, just a few very well chosen, well paired ingredients.
Yes, and you know, I think I was always brought up thinking about food in terms of visual attraction. So even if you take the simplest things, just to make it like appealing, you want to eat that with your eyes first before you put it in your mouth. And I think that comes with simple things as a piece of bread that you've toasted and chose quality ingredients to put on top of it.
And you grew up in northeastern France, and that certainly influenced your relationship with food. Tell us about growing up, and especially you talk about being just a little child and wanting to help in the garden with your grandmothers and your grandmother, your aunt, your mother.
Yeah, so like the village I come from is very small. It's 600 people, like a lot of cows. But everybody in the village, you know, has a vegetable garden and a fruit tree. And it was really the best way for me to grow up because, you know, my father's parents were farmers. So I was spending a lot of time there just with the animals, but also in my grandmother's garden. And the way I was educated to think about food was you eat what you have and what's in season. And of course, you know, but I for example, I remember my mother, if we were going to the store and, you know, in a city nearby, and we would see strawberries, and she would say, oh, we can't buy them, they are not in season. Mm-hmm. So it was very important just to buy what's available. And, you know, my mother taught me how to preserve fruit, and you know, she would basically collect peas and French beans, and then put them in preserves. So you know, you just the whole process with boiling the water and just blanching the vegetables, and then put them in those jars for the winter months. And she did that with making big pots of ratatouille. So you know, obviously at the time I was not necessarily aware the impact it would have on me. But you know, even as a teenager, I remember and I was in boarding school for many years also when I was in high school, and every weekend I was going home and I was just going in the cellar and I'm taking okay to them, taking ratatouille. Yeah. So I was making, doing my shopping in her own cellar, and I was so excited that I was going to eat her beans, you know. And I sure. remember she was always saying, you know, do you want les haricots du jardin? It was just such a bigger and better thing just to be able to have that.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's beans, garden beans, haricots
yes,
du jardin.
That's right. So, I mean, yes, like the French really a focus on where the food come from, this idea of terroir and you know, the relation of, you know, you have specific cheese attached to a certain area and how you actually label those. There's even like a term called appellation d'origine contrôlée, which means that you are saying that this cheese has been made specifically in a certain place in France, and you know, it's typically a label for quality as well.
And a good example of that is that sparkling wine can't be called champagne unless it's from the Champagne region of France, just for an example of that appellation. We're talking with Béatrice Peltre. She is a food blogger and photographer and the author of La Tartine Gourmande, Recipes for an Inspired Life. What are the flavors and recipes that say home for you? Have you played with those recipes or kept them traditional? And do you pay attention to what's in season, where it's grown, and even who you're buying those ingredients from? We'd love to hear from you when you call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And Beatrice, there's been a lot of discussion lately about how French children eat much better and are less picky than American children. Do you think that's true? And if so, why would that be?
Well, my experience of it is in France, there's definitely an emphasis on educating children to taste and not basically making special children's meals, or you know, these are the foods for children and these are the foods for adults. And even as a child, you know, I was always introduced to spices, herbs, and you know, the question of whether I like it or not was left to me, but at the same time I was given those options. And there's even a whole week in France devoted to taste, and it's actually called La Semaine du Goût, so which is the week of taste. And you know, there's special programs in schools that basically trying to educate children to just eat a balanced diet. And you know, even if they eat in a canteen, everything is labeled, and the children are supposed to take one food of each color, you know. So this just basically showing them, you know, you're supposed to take an appetizer, a salad, a main course, and a dessert, but not, you know, things of the same group and only eat that. So there's a very, very strong, I think, willingness just to do that with little children. And I think also another point that might actually explain why, you know, people believe that French children eat better. Again, you know, generalizing is risky at times, but there's such a strong care for a mealtime and taking time to eat together around the table. And even, you know, in schools, children are given much more time to eat. You know, they
Definitely.
Yes. So that's something that, you know, these are the tiny little details that I think when you add them up, just show that there's always more, you know, people call that sometimes obsession. Like my husband, when he first met me, said, like, your family is obsessed with food. But it's like, you know, we just really want just to just make sure that people develop a good education to food and appreciate and develop taste.
Well, and I think when children hear the adults around the table talking about the food in front of them and appreciating it and saying where it's from and how good these particular tomatoes are and talking about what they're going to enjoy for the next meal. I mean, it becomes really a much more focused, attentive exercise instead of just eating what's in front of you so you can get away from the table.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I have a 3-year-and-a-half-year-old daughter. And, of course, I have my own challenges, like every parent. But I can see that when I take her in the garden and she plants her own radishes and little exercise, you know, like this, just really impact her.
And we will talk more with Béatrice Pelt, the author of La Tartine Gourmande, Recipes from an Inspired Life, after this news. For many people around the world, French cuisine has a certain status as rich and sophisticated, expensive in a restaurant, and impossible to make at home. But at the heart of French cooking is a real passion for fresh, delicious, and seasonal ingredients showcased simply. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is food writer and photographer Béatrice Pelt. Her new book is La Tartine Gourmande, Recipes for an Inspired Life. Bea brings a passion and real joy to her cooking and is happy to share that and some of her tricks of the trade with you. Do you have family recipes that you've played with over the years? What would be your ideal meal to share with loved ones? I hope you'll join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or leave a question, comment, or even a recipe on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Stay tuned for a fun conversation about the wonders of finally prepared foods right after the news. This is a great time of year to be enjoying fresh seasonal produce and wonderful dairy products and all kinds of lovely things. And I think that there's a lot to be said for how the French think about food and put it together. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Béatrice Pelt is a food writer and photographer. She has a new book called La Tartine Gourmande, Recipes for an Inspired Life. And her blog is also La Tartine Gourmande. It's linked from our Facebook page. And it's full of delightful recipes and gorgeous photos. But she also shares where her love of food has come from and how it's developing over the years. Bea is joining us from the studios of WBGH in Boston. Bea, thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you.
So you do some really interesting things with some of those old favorites. For instance, one of the very traditional French recipes is basically a shepherd's pie with beef and potatoes. It's called haché parmentier. But you make a version with chicken and lime and coriander and coconut milk. Why do you think it's important to feel free to play with those old traditional dishes?
Well, I think it's just, you know, because there's a strong history of food and dishes that, you know, your grandparents made, your mother makes, everything, it's like fashion, you know, you always try to reinvent something. And I feel it's very important to keep those, but try just to see how you can just make them more whimsical or exotic. And it's also my high sense of curiosity for creating new things and testing new ingredients that I encounter, whether it's in the United States or when I travel. So I have a lot of fun doing that, but I also think I really want to keep the connection with the strong dishes that my mother brought up me with and my grandparents as well. It's giving food, I believe, to the history of food, generally speaking, and then keeping that very strong and solid and passing that to future generations as well. But, you know, with just different things and new approaches that can be appealing and again, intrigue and attract people that have same sensibility than I do.
And I actually tried a couple of your recipes. I don't know if you've been paying attention to the weather here in the Midwest, but we're dealing with 100-degree temperatures. Yes. So it was a little hard to get myself to cook as much as I wanted to. But I did try a couple things, and I put photos of them up on the Facebook page. One is, well, your recipe is a cranberry upside-down cake, which already is playing a little bit with what the usual fruits are, but really adopting that that American fruit, the cranberry. I actually changed it to rhubarb, since this is rhubarb. Mm-hmm. season. And I thought cranberry and rhubarb have a similar kind of tartness to them. And there's a photo there, and it was delicious. And I have to say that we had friends over, including a little six-year-old friend who was a little hesitant at first. She was going to taste her mom's piece, and then she was going to share her mom's piece. And then she finished her mom's piece, and I gave her mom a new piece, and our little friend started eating that one. And this is a pretty sophisticated taste. It has olive oil. It has almond meal, and it has saffron, and she loved the flavor of the saffron. And you know, it was a really delightful cake, not very sweet, which it's a much more French dessert in that way, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, you actually bring a point that is very important to me too. Again, as a mother, and when I first made food for my daughter, I never thought, because she's a child, I should remove cumin or coriander and all the things that actually I use a lot in my cooking. I just thought, you know, I'm going to introduce these to her and see what happens. And because I think I did this today, she's not going to be, oh, I can't eat this because there's this flavor, I don't know. And I always try to explain to her. If she makes or asks a question, what it is, I tell her what it is, and I'm not trying just to create things that are just void of taste. Instead, I'm trying to bring the flavors and then just basically expose her to a lot of different things. And you know, again, it's not something that might win all the time, and there are things that we are people, and then children are their own little people as well. But it's actually very important to do that, I think, and not feel like because they are children, you should not do that.
And the first time they try it, like an adult too, they might not care for it, but maybe on the second or third or fifth or tenth time, they'll think, oh, you know, I do like this. Mm-hmm. We'd love to have you join the conversation with Béatrice Peltre. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Miller. Another recipe of yours that I tried, Bea, was clafoutis. And in general, clafoutis is thought of as a dessert. It's a custard, often with whole cherries, or you also talk about making it with apricots, but it's definitely on the sweet side. You have a savory version, which has caramelized onions and cherry tomatoes, and there's some balsamic vinegar mixed in with those. You layer zucchini. There's both, I think I used Gruyere and on the inside, and then there's goat cheese on the top. It's a very wonderful savory main course that is based on a dessert.
That's right. And we actually love the same thing. You know, you talk about the tradition of what's traditional is a clafoutis, which is a custard flan with cherry stud inside. But at some point, someone decided to make a savory one. And then so many people experimented with it. And then there's tons of people that tried new recipes. And it was fun. You know, you just take something that we did the same thing with crumbles, you know, like, which is not a typical French food. But once the French adopted or like started, you know, making crumbles, all of a sudden they thought, okay, what about if we made savory crumbles? And so many options. And I think French people really are curious about new things and creating just things from something that is traditional. And the clafoutis is one example. The crumble is another one.
We have Carl and Madison on the phone, so let's go there. Hi, Carl.
Howdy. I've got two questions. One, my knowledge of French cuisine is limited to a period of time. I lived in New York about 35 years ago and for a few years. I don't remember any pickled foods being served and you want to eat in restaurants. And I myself, I've got some friends that have just gotten into pickling vegetables, and recently I got some green beans that were pickled that were absolutely fantastic. So my first question is what's the place of pickle foods in French cuisine? And my second question is sort of an extension of a conversation that was on the air a few days ago. A French author was discussing a book she had written about how children in France are introduced to food. And I've got friends of mine here that are always making excuses for their kids not liking this or that and saying that, their palates are too sensitive and whatnot. Now, the producer thought I was talking about the difference between French and American children, and it isn't. It's just that Americans seem to always give their kids a buy on the food, and I don't believe it. I don't think their palates are that sensitive that they shouldn't like beets or whatever.
Well, let's see what Bea has to say about that. Bea, what about pickled foods?
Well, it is true that pickled food is not necessarily as or occupies as big of a place as American cuisine or like even English cuisine. But we do have a few. I mean, the first one is the basic one that my mom was always making was the cornichon, which is basically what's the English word even?
Little
for cornichon?
Pickles, the little sour
but
pickles.
Like that's right, and we do that with little onions as well. But it's not. It's not something that is actually or occupies such a big place, and we should, because I think it's lovely just to have a lot of nice pickled, even red onion pickled. Mm-hmm. It's, it's just beautiful foods. And the second question is the question more about whether in France we are not giving excuses to to our children if they don't eat? I think what I think is true is, we give the food, and if children eat it, it's fine. If they don't, well, it's too bad. You know, it's just basically that's what dinner is all about. And it's not going to be, the mother rushing in the kitchen thinking, oh, I have to make something else because my child is not eating. Because the French, generally speaking, might not think in terms of developing special meals for their children. They introduce them to a wider variety before, and it's like they train them differently, maybe. That's the mm-hmm. way to look at it.
I think French children don't expect that their tastes will necessarily be catered to in the same way.
That's right. And I think it's just, they're very smart. So they, of course, a child would have a tendency to try to eat foods that they like best, but if they see that's what the meal is all about, and they have just to basically follow, and in a way it's just becomes transparent. That's what dinner is about, and they eat, they don't eat. Well, that's just what it is.
Right. Thanks for that call, Carl. And Jeannie on the Facebook page wrote, I love fresh pesto with basil from the garden. I've heard you can use other herbs to make pesto, but I've never tried these. Any suggestions for other pesto-like recipes?
Oh, yes. Well, as no longer than yesterday, I made even an asparagus pesto with arugula.
Oh.
So, I actually love to use different kinds of herbs, tarragon, parsley, coriander. That's actually a food that I play with a lot, what's at hand. My sense of cooking is also about I always keep a very stocked up kitchen with what I call the basics. And I have, I'm lucky to be able to grow herbs in the garden. So I have a variety of those. And if it's not in season, I keep a lot in the fridge. But, and then I think, okay, what could I make tonight? I have a bunch of asparagus. I have some pistachios. So instead of using pine nuts, you use pistachios. And then, you just follow kind of like, you experiment. That's the way I actually like to think about when I develop recipes, is I feel like I'm a little bit like the chemist in my own lab and just, okay, today is this. And sometimes it works, sometimes it's horrible, but that's the way you learn and educate yourself to be adventurous with food.
Right, and actually the segment that we did just before talking with you, Bea, was all about the biology and science of how we taste and what we taste and mm-hmm. how tastes work together. So there is both an art and a science to cooking. If you have a question for Beatrice, please give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bea, some of your recipes, as we said, are traditional ones, but with a twist. You also use a variety of flours other than wheat flours in the recipes, which makes them gluten-free. I think a lot of people think that gluten-free means that you're missing out on something, but you actually make those substitutions by choice. Why is that?
Well, it's something that I needed to do at some point, and you know, past the decision of making it, I actually really discovered such a word that I didn't know, and I felt like I was making my baked goods better, more flavorful, better nutritiously speaking as well, that I just wanted to stick with it. And I thought, you know, it's such a wonderful thing to be able to discover different way of baking. And when I started to switch to cooking gluten-free exclusively, I felt like I was a much stronger cook and a much stronger baker because I had pushed myself to opening some doors I would not have otherwise. And, you know, you look at flours like millet or quinoa or amaranth, and these are much more filled with proteins. And, you know, you feel better about eating those, which is always something that I emphasize as well. I mean, keeping a balanced diet, one that is focused on healthy eating habits as well. So that includes eating ingredients loaded with nutrition and as well as, you know, quality ingredients.
You also talk about the tools that you find indispensable in your kitchen. What are some of the basics that you just couldn't live without?
I know this is much more like of a whim, but I absolutely love my mandoline or mandolin, however you say.
I think mandolin, yeah.
Yes.
And
yes,
not the stringed instrument, a little slicer.
Yes, and you know, it's just unless you have very, very high skills using the knives, which I don't necessarily have, or I don't have the patience. The mandolin, again, because I just love to create beautiful looking foods. And when I make salads, you know, when you just slice a radish or like fennel, just using that tool is just making things much more, they flow, you know, and you really make. Out of really simple things, you can make beauty. And that's what I always want to emphasize, too. You don't need to be like feeling like you have to know how to cook or you have so much experience. With very small things, you can create beautiful dishes that will impress yourself and your family and your friends when they come over. And I think that's also what I want to convey with my book. It's just, you know, these foods are very accessible and they're easy to make. You know, just little tools here and there, like the mandoline or like even just a good vegetable peeler. Mm-hmm. And then you take a carrot or zucchini and then you create, for example, you shave the zucchini and the carrot. And then you just steam those vegetables and you create this idea that you're eating pasta, but it's actually like tagliatelle. Yes. of vegetables. And it's beautiful and so simple. You know, so it's just sometimes those tools, just how you cut the vegetable is really making the difference.
Well, and also, you know, going back to kind of those very basic things, you also provide some very basic recipes in your book, La Tartine Gourmande, for basic sauces, basic pastry crusts, things like that. So so people can have those foundations that then they can, you know, you can master the foundations and then you can get as creative as you want because you've got those building blocks.
Exactly. And that's myself as a cook. That's the way I feel. Like if I know how to make a crust, you know, it's even when I started learning about baking, it's like I feel like when I create new recipes for muffins or cakes, I use a formula in my head of how much fat I need, how many eggs, how much flour, so to speak, and sugar. You know, I'm someone who doesn't like to eat or to put too much sugar. I don't like things that are overly sweet. So I have my formula in my head. And then because I feel strong about it, I can build and then play with it. And I think that's true with a lot of things. You just, you know, have a very solid basic basis, and then you just basically feel freer just to do adventurous things in the kitchen.
Michael on Facebook comments about what we were talking about taking different elements from different cultures and different cuisines to make something new and exciting. He said it took years of trying and the internet to find out how to make this many-layered meal, and he's talking about pho, which is a Vietnamese noodle soup, mm-hmm. and he talks about how France and Southeast Asia have shared influences back and forth. He says his trick is to make the good pho is to grill the ginger and onion so they melt into the soup. And he said, like his home brewing, I'm assuming he's talking about beer, it's a big pot and hours of boiling and great results.
So. Yeah, that sounds lovely, actually.
Well, and I remember you talking in the book about your Dutch neighbors at one point who you were so surprised that they used so many Indonesian elements.
Yeah.
And it was that colonial relationship between Indonesia and Holland.
Yes, and you know, what was very interesting is when I first moved to the United States, which was just for a year in 95 at first, that was my first exposure to completely different food cultures. Because when you're in France, I mean, of course, you do have exotic restaurants and you can eat Italian, Spanish, you know, anything, especially in big cities. But where I'm from, it was not necessarily the case. So when you go to France, you really eat French. And that's probably why people go there as well, if they want to eat French food. Whereas when I came and moved to the United States, I was stunned by the complexity and the whole melting pot that existed about foods. And the Netherlands, for my friends Frank and Mary, was the same. They educated me to, well, how people migrating to a country, you know, really bring their own foods and then basically impact the way a food culture develops. The thing with the French, they are so strong already about their own foods. They're a little more closed up into, you know, taking in more. So it's still going to be very French rooted, I think, with exotic touches, which is what I'm trying to do myself. Is I have a very strong French basis, but I actually try to enrich it by my living overseas, having traveled the world. And I also think that I would not have been able to write my book had I lived in France. I think it would have been a completely different book.
Mm-hmm.
I became aware of my roots and a strong sense of nostalgia, too, about my upbringing, the countryside, you know, going apple picking and doing all those things as a child. And I really wanted to recreate that here and think about it. And I'm lucky I live in an area in the United States where I can do all those things because we have tons of beautiful orchards all around. And I, you know, I do that. I mean, I want to be one of those people that actually want to be able to help farmers and the education to fruit picking, for example.
We have just a few minutes left, but I want to get to Wanda in Fort Washington, who's on the phone. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. Yes, I kind of had a quick question. In my cooking lifetime, I find that some of my friends are really good bakers, and some of them are cooks. So, you know, they like to do just regular cooking, and they can't bake with crap. So I'm just curious, I mean, do you find that that's a common thing? Like, for me, I'm a cook. I hate measuring stuff, so I hate to bake, but I love to try new herbs. And dill is my favorite. The dill leaves, I love to, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Some people like to cook. Some people like to bake. Is that something that's common?
Yeah, let's see what Bea has to say about that. What do you think, Bea?
Well, in my case, I'm lucky that I love both, and I really love to experiment with both. What I think is, you know, it's one other point that is something that I noticed is the way, for example, French cookbooks are written. It's like when I had to write my cookbook, I was asked and advised to basically spell out more things. When you look actually at the French cookbooks, you really realize that there's an assumption of people knowing how to cook already a little bit. And it's true for baking. It's true for cooking. It's like this is something that's supposed to be like there. And, you know, it's maybe, again, like the education to food from being a very young child. So I think there's a little bit of both. But definitely in my case, I'm lucky to be like embracing both.
I'm married to one who does both very well, but I definitely am better as a cook than a baker, I have to say. And yeah. I think actually it's more that baking intimidates me. It seems like there's less margin of error in baking.
Well,
and that
makes
me nervous.
That's what a lot of people say too. When you bake, you know, you have to be much more precise, which is true. It's like, you know, when you speak a foreign language, just have to do it,
right.
You know, and you make mistakes and that's okay, you know, and that's actually how people learn. And that's the way I've certainly learned because I'm self-taught, and I really enjoyed the learning process.
And Bea, in just the few seconds we have left, what are you cooking for dinner tonight?
Probably, it's like a quick question. No, I have like, I went to the store to buy a lot of vegetables and then the farmer's market. So I have a medley of zucchini, tomato, and I might just do, and actually peas. So I might do a French it's called like a peas stew kind of thing, but it's more like you just cook the peas with a lot of garlic and fresh herbs and the carrots and put a bit of tomato and add the lettuce at the end. Mm. And then just serve that with a grilled meat and then a fresh salad on the side.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, just like, again, peas are in season, so I actually try to enjoy them as much as they last.
Well, and I posted a link to your fava bean and green pea tartine recipe,
yes.
Using those things in season. Béatrice Pelt, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Béatrice Pelt is a food blogger, photographer, and author. She's from northeastern France, but makes her home in Boston. And she's the author and photographer of a gorgeous new book, La Tartine Gourmande, Recipes for an Inspired Life. And tomorrow coming up, it's Friday already, which means it's time for Garden Talk. Barb Larson is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Kenosha County. She'll help us keep our gardens healthy in spite of this summer's extreme weather. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening.